When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Lore Watch, a roundtable freeform discussion about lore and our favorite video games. I'm your host, Joe Perez, one of several lore-focused folks from Blizzard Watch, and I've got my stupendous co-host with me today, Matt Rossi. How are you doing today, Matt?
I'm okay.
We are all okay, or at least I hope we are okay. Today we are going to be taking one last break from our series on the artifact weapons and the story behind them to answer more of your questions. I figured many of you sent them in as we've been asking. So, it's a pretty good reason to take a break and answer some of those questions. Again, if you do have questions for this podcast or any of our podcasts, be sure to send them into podcasts@blizzardwatch.com. If you are a Patreon supporter, you can go ahead and join us on Discord. We have a Patreon queue and podcast questions channel where we do look for our questions first as a way of saying thank you to our patrons for allowing us to continue to do shows like this and, well, generally operate the site. If you can't afford to support us on Patreon, we understand that, but you can also ask us questions in our regular queue and podcast questions channel on Discord. And also, just as a reminder, we are available on pretty much every streaming platform, Spotify, Apple Music, all the good stuff where a lot of the other podcasts are. If you are listening to us on a platform that has the ability to share or to give a review, please feel free to do so. And make sure you tell your friends about us. Every little bit of that also helps us, even if you can't support us monetarily. And also, tweeting to people that listen to us is always an acceptable thing in my book, as far as I'm concerned. Anything to add to that before we actually get into the questions, Matt?
No.
All right. We're going to go ahead and get into our questions. First on comes from Stouty Poofs. There's actually a two set. We'll start with one and then move on to the other. So pretty sure we will no longer have a Lich King when we return and no Banshee Queen with Valkyr to keep the Forsaken going. So what do they think the future holds for Undead and Death Knights? Will they simply die out? We answered this a little bit, but I wanted to come back to it and give it a little more time in the sun because we answered it sort of at the end of the last episode. Did we cover everything with this? Do we think that there is anything else that is on the horizon for Death Knights in particular? Because, you mentioned...
No, just the grave. It gapes for them. They will all file into it and be crushed down, and their bodies will decompose, and that will be there is no hope of the Forsaken.
I don't know how to respond to that, Matt.
Well, they're Forsaken. They should like dark gothic statements of brooding misery and despair. If you don't like that stuff, why are you playing one? I said before that I hope they do some stories about the fact that they're essentially doomed. That, we've seen throughout multiple lore sources now that the Forsaken fall apart without constant maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
Like they have to have new jaws sewn on, new limbs attached, that their bodies decompose and they have to have stuff replaced. That's why some Forsaken don't have a jaw. If you can play a Forsaken with their eyes basically grafted on with a big X of leather over your head. I think it would be cool to have some stories that deal with this. And like I believe I said before, I don't know if I said this part or you said it or what have you. There's characters who you could really explore this idea with. There's Callie Amenethil, who's not forsaken, but is definitely undead, and who is kind of represents a new kind of undeath. That there could be some, can she help bring what she is to them? Can she help the Callie style of undead, since it uses the light, seems to be similar to the process that makes the light born and light forged, in that it doesn't seem, she seems like immaculate, for lack of a better word. She seems to not be decaying. She's just there, held in stasis, essentially. Maybe she could bring that to them. I don't know. That'd be one thing to think about, one story that might be told. Another would be to tell stories with characters who have existed for a while within the Forsaken, but who haven't really quite pushed over into being dominant characters, like Leonid Bartholomew. Now that Sylvanas is no longer the Banshee Queen, does he come back? Does he try to help the Forsaken, which he is one of? I'm trying to remember the name of the very prominent assassin that we first met in, I think, the Cataclysm revamp. And she was there when we did the new Scarlet Monastery and the new Strathholm.
Lillian Voss.
Yeah, Lillian Voss. Thank you. I could not remember her name.
That's okay.
But we could do more stories with her and her attempt to bring the Forsaken into something like stability. You know, what does she do? Does she step up finally? Does she become the faction leader, since we're told Callie won't be? I don't know, but I'd like to see deal with the story elements. Don't just hand wave it away with another MacGuffin to make them, you know, perpetual again. That being perpetual should not be a part of the Forsaken story. That's the whole point of them, is that this is...
Hence the name Forsaken.
There's an element of this existence that is like a curse. It is, you're trapped. You can't go on. You can't move to the next place. And you're stuck in this half existence. I think they should explore it. I think they should go forth from here and look at what that means.
And this is why
just come up with a new way around it.
This is why I wanted to bring the question back up, is because I've been thinking about this a lot since last week, and I agree with you. And this is something that we talked about. Oh, they'll keep surviving. I don't want to say we short answered it a little bit, but now that I've had time to sort of ruminate on it, I think that the whole concept of the Forsaken, like you said, should be explored. But also, I'd be okay if it died out, if they were reborn anew and no longer called the Forsaken. And I know some people would be very upset about that, but it would be almost like an identity shift. And that's when they find themselves, or potentially find themselves, in a new position after a lengthy period of reevaluation and introspection, or after a lengthy period of, for lack of a better term, being fixed. Because let's not sugarcoat it. Lillian Voss is picking up the pieces that Sylvanas left behind and is doing something, even starting in Battle for Azeroth, that she never intended to do, right? She wanted to, when we first met her, she begged for the release of death. She wanted to be ended because her existence was nothing but pain after her task was completed. We obviously did not oblige her, and come Battle for Azeroth, she's become one of the most important Forsaken characters I think we've ever had outside of Sylvanas in-game. And she's doing kindnesses here and there, whether it's that Tide Sage's family and making sure that they were taken care of, promising that they would be taken care of, understanding his pain, trying to guide him through that.
I'm not trying to interrupt you. I know you're making a really good point, and I want to keep listening, but when you say that she promised to take care of them, all I could cut to in my head was Lillian Voss leaving a house and then bursts into flames, and she's like, there, taken care of. I'm sorry, but that's all that was in my head. I had to share that.
That's fair. No, that's fair. But it was interesting because it was a more human moment for Lillian to present in that sort of storytelling than I think even the Alliance was getting from the humans themselves at the time. Like, even with Anduin and everything he was trying to do, it was almost, I don't want to say the word is on the tip of my tongue. It was almost a selfish act and
self-gratifying.
Thank you. Why couldn't I do that? Words are hard, people. It was almost a selfish act that he was doing this. It almost presented like, I'm doing this to absolve myself of some sin, even though he didn't need to. It was almost a guilt about it, if that makes sense. At least the way that I went back and started rereading it this week. I would love to see them born from the ashes of the Forsaken anew, whether it's with Lillian Voss's leadership picking up those pieces and giving them purpose again. Because don't forget, their original purpose was just the spit at the Lich King, basically, to seek revenge in spite of everything he put them through. That's been done. That's been done multiple times over now. And I think that's part of why the Forsaken have become sort of listless a little bit. They don't really have a purpose besides existence and decay, like you pointed out. So if they can come out of this with a sense of purpose, picking up the pieces that were left behind by all the damage Sylvanas did, and maybe find a new path forward, maybe with the help of Lillian Voss, I'm here for it. And then combine that with Kalia Menethil, and maybe they find a way to stop the decay and the pain. And that's the same thing that I was thinking about the Death Knights. One of the things that I think is interesting about the Death Knights is, and we've talked about this before when we did the entire episode about Death Knights, is that there is a certain amount of pain. There's a certain amount of like anger and aggression that they feel, even when they're not directly under the influence of the Lich King, that they need to do certain things, just like Forsaken do, to release what it does to them, to sort of balance themselves out, whether it's murder or torture. A lot of it is very dark, dirty stuff. But now that the Helm of Domination is gone, now that the Lich King is gone, does this mean that Death Knights can also start to move forward away from that? Are they still going to be racked by sort of that controlling pain that has defined them for so long? Or do they get to also find a new purpose? And that's the other thing that I think is interesting. They were originally supposed to be part and parcel of the Lich King's generals, essentially, right? They're supposed to help control and lead the hordes of undead.
I mean, and some still did. Not some, every Death Knight went over.
Sure.
When the Ebon Blade did. There was some of them you even saw up in Ice Crown leading. Yeah. You saw them leading and so forth. So, yeah. I do think that the Death Knight thing, I suppose I said Demon Hunters, different group. The Death Knight thing is complicated because some of what we're talking about with the pain that they have, that's necessary for their existence. Mm-hmm. If they stop doing it, they stop existing. They would just fall apart because the magic that fuels them, the necromantic energy that drives them, it's more self-sustaining. You'll notice that unlike a Forsaken, a non-Forsaken Death Knight doesn't look decayed. And even the Forsaken ones look different.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because the magic that's sustaining them is intended to be more powerful. It is not the same as the Plague of Undeath that created the Forsaken. Because he wanted them to have their faculties. He wanted them to be, you know, able to obey his orders precisely, to think and have initiative. It's a dangerous thing to do. You still see it with like the Four Horsemen. The Four Horsemen are very much fully intelligent, and to the point where Zeliek is still believes in the light.
Mm-hmm.
To the point where, and I bring it up constantly because damn it, Zeliek does not get enough attention.
I would agree.
But that's the thing about Death Knights is that because the magic used to keep them moving is so much more complicated, they literally have to inflict pain to fuel it. So that's never going to stop. It's just a question of what are we inflicting pain on? You know, where does the violence go? You know, we can't stop doing it, but we can do it for our own purposes. We can pick our targets. To a certain degree, the Death Knights have kind of already hit upon that role. And we saw that in Legion. They've already started to think, okay, we're going to exist for the defense of Azeroth. We're going to keep the world safe the way only we can, because we're the only ones who are dark enough. You know, they're sort of like, if Paladins are your Superman analog, the Death Knights have settled into the Batman one. They're sure they're going to hurt people. Sure. They're going to wreck stuff. They're not going to ask permission when they decide we have to do this thing. And it's not always going to be popular. Like if right now the Red Dragonflight does not like them. But their intention is the defense and preservation of Azeroth and life on Azeroth. So they've sort of set themselves up in that role already. After Shadowlands, it's going to be interesting because there's not a Lich King. Who leads? Does Bolvar lead? He seems to have settled into a leadership role.
I mean, he was sort of bred for that in life. I mean, it just seems natural that he would maintain that, right?
And the other Death Knights seem to accept him, even when he is not the Lich King, as the leader. But then again, we don't know for a fact that someone asked us a question on the other podcast about how the Primus kind of took the helmet, kind of wink, wink, nudge, nudged, and sent us off to fight the Jailer after it was reforged into the Helm of Will. We don't know what's going to happen with that helmet.
No,
and
we
know there's going to be an epilogue. There's going to be an epilogue patch before the next patch comes out. We know there will be a patch that kind of closes up the story here. We could see that helmet go back on Bolvar's head now that it's a different helmet.
And change
him into something else entirely.
Yeah.
We have no idea. We don't know.
But that's
just one possibility.
That's kind of what I was thinking. It was like, does that change? And also, like, with the Helm of Domination being the source of the magic of this round of Death Knights, because it wasn't like originally where they were just souls and truncheons, right? This is souls grafted back into bodies that are sustained by this ever-powerful magic that allows them to not decay. Does now that that source has been shifted, changed, and reforged, does the magic possibly change too? Because we have no idea. And we have no idea. No,
absolutely it doesn't. It's exactly the same. No, I'm kidding. I don't know.
But it's a fascinating thing for me because it's one of those things where it's like, maybe it becomes a thing where just the will to exist becomes the self-sustaining portion of that magic. Where these Death Knights who, let's be honest, like Bolvar and the new Four Horsemen, and Darien as well, they're some of the best characters I think they've had in a very long time. I love White Mane as one of the
White
Mane
as a Death Knight is really good, actually.
Absolutely phenomenal.
I totally agree.
But like, they have a really good core of characters that are all extremely willful. And these were all ones that in life were bastions of willpower, which I think is absolutely fascinating. Does that mean now that if the source of the magic potentially changes, that they no longer have to have that pain associated with it, and that their will just literally fuels the spell itself? And then Death Knights become these stalwart bastions of defense, kind of what like the Kyrian are supposed to, or the Maldraxxons are supposed to be for the Shadowlands. Do they now guard the pathways into our world as those bastions of willpower? I don't know. I really want to see something play out with them as well, because I actually think Death Knights are super, super cool, and I expected to get more with them in this expansion, but we haven't yet. And it seems like, I don't want to say like a missed opportunity because I don't know what the plan was.
Here's the thing. I'm just going to say this. I've been thinking about it for a while. It feels to me like due to the pandemic and due to the switch to work from home, that a chunk of the story just ended up not happening.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they just didn't get it ready in time. Maybe they decided to streamline the story. I don't know. I wasn't there. But I've had friends say things that have made me think that this is the case.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I personally have liked Shadowlands.
I really have too. Yeah.
But I definitely feel like there's parts of it that just kind of stop. Like it feels like the bit from defeating Sylvanas to here feels a little ragged.
Because it seems like in between that would have been a good time for us to deal with some of the loose ends, like the Death Knights, like the Drust, like some of that other stuff, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But I will say that I don't know that we're going to get something that ambitious this expansion. I think at this point, the last patch we get is going to just be here's the next expansion patch where we figure out what's going on in the next expansion. Since we're going to hear about that in about 20 days or so, I think April 19th. So not 20 days, but you know, in like 3 weeks, we're going to hear what that expansion is. I don't want to bank on it being a major thing that's established now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Just because I think it's the chances are really good that it won't be what they deal with now, and thus people like us will be disappointed. I definitely wanted more Death Knight stuff in this expansion. And it felt like they were going there with the bit where you freed Darien.
Yes.
And, you know, he met his father and there was that whole thing. If I had a magic lamp, one of the things that would absolutely be happening is that Alexandros Mograine would be coming back with the Death Knights as a Death Knight. Like straight up, he would come back from the dead as a Death Knight and be a Death Knight, because I'd love, and not just him. There's several characters. Like I would actually imagine this whole Maldraxxus Death Knight exchange where Death Knights spend a tour in Maldraxxus helping defend the Shadowlands, and Maldraxxi come to the land of the living to train Death Knights in better abilities. And so you could get Lady Vash showing up from time to time.
You have the good Morgraine.
you could get Draka showing up. And they'd use it as a chance to also, you know, deal with stuff like Draka would probably want to talk to Thrall while she was there.
Oh, yeah, probably. Like that. And they did some of that with Korthia. Like, they had some conversations between the characters mm-hmm. when you were in Korthia that hinted that there might have been more to do with that. Like, Alexandros and Darian talking with each other, right? So, yeah, I think we have... And here's my pie in the sky before we move on, is that I kind of hope that... Now that we get the announcement coming up of the next expansion, that the in-between time starts to deal with some of this stuff. And we talked about this before. We talked about this on the other podcast about having sort of like a cadence or roadmap of content. This is a really good opportunity for that, right? It's this opportunity that we could maybe capitalize on to start backfilling some of those lore problems. I don't want to say lore problems. Some of those story opportunities that maybe got truncated because of everything that happened. This would be a good way to maybe start pulling on those threads a little, maybe not fully explore, but set them up to go further in the future. Right. So, all right, I think we're going to move on to our next set, which we've already answered the other one from you, Stouty Poofs. We're not going to do that again this week. But thank you very much. I just wanted to revisit this one because I thought there was more to talk about with it. Our next one comes from Queen Enthi. What do you think the jailer told Sylvanas to get her on his side?
Nothing.
Uh-huh.
I'm not kidding.
Go for
it, Matt. He did not start this whole thing. He did not directly communicate with her. The Valkyr first, you know, made the deal with her to get her back into the land of the living. That's the beginning of the door being opened. I do not believe that the jailer ever made direct contact with her until well after she'd gone to Helya, made the deal with Helya, and gotten the lantern that would allow her to control Aeir. Helya knew full well that wasn't going to work, because even if, you know, Werewolf Grandpa hadn't shown up and messed it up, Odin wouldn't have allowed it. Mm-hmm. And he's the one that, you know, created Aeir. He would have acted. So she knew that when that failed, Sylvanas would be truly desperate. And thus, when Sylvanas indeed failed and was truly desperate, then Helya could introduce her to the next stage. That's when it happened. And it wasn't anything the jailer told her. It was Helya, with a little bit of help from Wizala, who engineered all of this.
Mm-hmm.
It was never the jailer. The jailer doesn't deign to explain himself. He doesn't bother to explain himself. You could tell in the final confrontation between Sylvanas and the jailer, when she's like turns on him, you could tell that he'd never even thought to hide what he was going to do from her. He didn't care if she knew. She was a cog.
Mm-hmm.
You know, someone else got her on the plan. That's fine. She'll do what he tells her to do. When you see Sylvanas talking with the jailer when you're in Torghast, and there's that little scene between the two of them, watch the way they interact.
Mm-hmm.
He does not look at her. He is not listening to her. He doesn't care. There's stuff about Zoval I don't like. There's stuff about the introduction and interaction of Zoval I don't like. One of the things I love about him is that he does not give a rat's behind about anything else than his stated goal, you know? And he does a lot of what he does through sheer intimidation.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he gets Denathrius on board without promising Denathrius anything. You know, it is fascinating to look at the way that the jailer's, his forces work, that it's broken up into these weird little fiefdoms and they're all kind of like in charge from their own angle. And I definitely don't think he said anything to her to get her on his side. He didn't have to. That's what he has other people for. It was most certainly Helya that chipped away at that stone.
And
that's my take on it.
I tend to agree. And it's one of the things that we've talked about before, and I've also thought about a lot on my own, and as I'm sure, I mean, I know you have as well. But look at Sylvanas' trajectory ever since Wrath of the Lich King. And I always come back to this. I know I always come back to this. But there's this moment where she throws herself off the top of Ice Crown, the task, quote unquote, done. And because there's nothing left for her, her purpose is gone. And this always struck me as odd in the presentation, but now has made more sense over the years. In that moment, the first thing she sees is darkness. Nothing but darkness and pain, right? So this is deliberate, I feel, because at the time, we now know what we didn't know then is that Kyrian ferry the souls to the Shadowlands. Valkyr are a twisted version of the Kyrian. Valkyr were already at the Ice Crown Citadel. Those Kyrian then take her soul to a place where she can only see darkness, and then the deal is struck, where now those Valkyr are in service to Sylvanas, and they do what they're supposed to do by Helya's orders quite well throughout that time, subtly influencing her, letting her know what they know about the lands beyond reality or our reality, what actually does await after death. So it's when Matt says it's a slow decay, it's a slow decay, and it is by design that it chips away at her. And it's that moment though that everything starts getting further and further down the hill. It's if you've ever been like skiing, there's a certain point where, like, if you're on a very steep hill, if you go too far too quickly, you have the chance of losing control. If you go too far slowly, you don't realize you're losing control. And that's kind of what happened to Sylvanas. She started on that path, and it was just little things by little things by little things. And then going to the death of Vol'jin, Moisala putting that bug in Vol'jin's ear and making her war chief was by design. And it wasn't for what everybody thought it was, I don't think. And we've talked about this a lot, too. But I don't think it was because she would be this agent of war. I think it was because the pressure would get to her. Because she wasn't a leader in that regard. Even when she led the Forsaken, even as the Ranger General, she wasn't a statesman. She wasn't a politician. She wasn't somebody who went out of her way to placate or handhold other dignitaries from other factions. That wasn't who she was. She was a general. She was somebody who was used to working in the background or in the shadows with a very direct course of action. But now it wasn't like that anymore. Go to Before the Storm. Read the book about what happened with the Forsaken, the Council of Desolation, and everything that happened with her people, and her feeling like she's losing a grip on that. As a general, of course she's going to view stuff like that as insubordination, not the same way Anduin would. Anduin would view, my people aren't happy, what do I do to fix it? Sylvanas, my people aren't happy, I'm going to go kill them now. It's this massive mounting of everything that she is not, or not supposed to be, or not comfortable with, that just completely breaks her down and lets her become malleable to anything that the jailer wants. Because now the jailer's telling her, it doesn't have to be like this. I can make it better. Doesn't have to promise her a thing. Just like he didn't promise Denathrius anything. Doesn't have to say anything specific. She's already at a point where all she's known is pressure and pain and lack of purpose. And now she knows that beyond the walls of life, death is a farce. There is no rest. You are nothing but fuel for an infinite, uncaring universe. Of course she's going to go along with it. Is it the right choice? No. Was it the only choice she thought she could make? Maybe. Will she regret that for the rest of her existence? Probably, now that she has her full soul back. But it's always been fascinating to me because I don't think we haven't seen the full weight of it yet. And I think there's going to be an exposition dump at some point, very likely between Sylvanas and Uther, where we'll be able to hear them talk about this and talk about what her journey was. Whether it's in a book or whether it's in the game, we will hear about it. But that's going to do it for that question. We're going to move on to the next one. This one comes from our friend Lord Soth. Could you maybe explain the ending of the raid a bit more? I feel like I have zero understanding of what that cinematic was. Mild spoiler warning then for you folks at home, probably for the next 5 to 10 minutes. Then you can come back. The end cinematic of defeating the jailer inside of the Sepulchre of the first ones is, I don't want to say like abrupt, but it is not quite what I expected. It is a recounting of his point of view a little bit of what happened to him and having his portion of his soul ripped off when ripped out, basically the purpose of his vessel ripped out and then used as an automata inside of Ouroboros to sort souls, while seeing how his quote unquote family, his brothers and sisters, react to him and their individual responses to him before he's locked away in his own prison in the Maw, which is, I think, fascinating. But the end sequence is him almost conveying that there's a larger threat that he was trying to prepare the universe for. This is the first we hear about this larger threat, maybe not the first we really hear about it, but the first we hear about it from a cosmic being. And we see him start to power down as now his purpose has already been taken over by another vessel, and when another soul, right? So his purpose now lives on as the Arbiter with Pelagos sort of driving that mecha suit around, right? He is no longer needed. He is disassembled and broken down to his primal core components, which in this case we now know is a vessel framework. And we wouldn't know about that until after this week, story had just passed. When we shoved the soul into there, and after the whole thing with what the vessels are, and also going through the raid and seeing that there's an infinite number of these vessels available, we kind of have an idea of that. So he's going to an inert state. That's really it. Unless I'm missing something, that's the cinematic I saw. And I didn't really see anything too much in there aside from this vagueness that he might have been maybe a little bit right, but not in the right way. Now, you've seen the cinematic, Matt?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
Well, it starts with the ice cream party, of course. I don't know why you didn't mention the ice cream party. It's very important. Now,
well, because the sprinkles are cursed, Matt. That's why.
Well, yeah, but, you know, it also contains monosodium glutamate. Anyway, no, seriously, though. I don't think there is a lot to the cinematic, and I think people are kind of trying to force it into meaning more than it does.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, it's the big end expansion deal. We beat the jailer. I think Joe's analysis of what you see is pretty accurate. You get the because Denathrius is not going to be showing up to give the jailer a hard time at this point. Like, they didn't bamf in here and say these things again. This is him remembering it the last time it happened.
Despite Denathrius being elsewhere now.
Yeah, so Denathrius is, we don't even know where Denathrius is, do we?
No.
He was in the sword, and then he bamfed out.
The sword got broken free by the...
The Dreadlords.
The Dreadlords, yeah. So he's probably...
Yeah, Denathrizim, so...
He's probably wherever the Denathrizim have held up shop. He might be on Argus.
Yeah, we don't know. We have no idea where they are. But regardless, it is basically him, you know, him saying at the time he did it that it was necessary, that his goal was to defend reality from incursion. I want to get the exact quote, so give me a sec here. He basically makes the point, he says something along the line of, a cosmos divided cannot survive what is to come. And of course, we all want to know, what does that mean? But the cinematic does not tell us what that means. It is very clear from watching the cinematic, though, that the jailer is a construct.
Mm-hmm.
He's very similar in a way to the Titans, who are themselves like massively powerful spirits animating planets or being born out of planets. It's kind of complicated, but nonetheless, it definitely seems that he was made. That Zereth Mortis implies that the entire Eternal Ones were all constructed. And there's also, even prototypes.
I was going to say, and there's also some implications in there as well with this past week's story chapter of mm-hmm. the Titans.
Yep. And we don't, there's a lot we don't know yet, mm-hmm. But it is definitely seems to be the case that these beings were made and put in place to keep a balance between these forces, that the intention all along was that there be a balancing force. The trouble is that every time we get lore in World of Warcraft, it is almost always from a particular slant or point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Chronicle was written from the point of view of beings that knew of the Titans, if not the Titans themselves. And thus it approached things in a specific way. The Codex of the Shadowlands approached that same stuff from a completely different perspective. And everyone was like, why'd they change the cosmic order? Until someone pointed out, they just flipped it. It's as if you think of this as a three-dimensional object and you just turn it. That kind of thing. What the jailer is talking about, we don't know yet. We don't know what is to come. We know that whatever it is, he felt that he could use Azeroth and the power in Azeroth to remake reality in such a way that it would survive what he believes is coming. Why does he think that? What was he going to do? We just keep getting told he was going to remake reality. We don't know what his goal was. I mean, we know the method of his goal. We know what he was going to do to achieve it. We don't know what it was. How is he going to prevent reality from being doomed by what is to come? What is to come? Don't know. So watching the cinematic, if you are expecting to come out of it with a full understanding of what the heck just happened, you're not going to get it because that's not what they're doing. But if you watch it understanding this is his final defeat, now that he is no longer the Arbiter, and now that he doesn't have the power that he tore out of the Arbiter, he's nothing. There is no more him. And the form that he takes is the unanimated, unpowered, for lack of a better word, unsouled version of him.
Yeah, like you even see the soul sort of snuffing out. Like it is ceasing to exist at the end of that cinematic. And I think
the runes on his face actually stop glowing. And you remember those runes he's got all over himself? They're still there when everything ends for him. When he is defeated, the runes that they marked him with, because in the flashback, you see him talking without the runes.
Mm-hmm.
And then they marked him with the runes to make him the jailer. And you see those runes are still there. Like that part is still there. The binding they put on him is still there. So it is really fascinating to watch, but it isn't trying to like give you everything about it.
Yeah. And I think that's really the important takeaway, right? It is not meant to be the info dump. And I think we've sort of been conditioned to have those final cinematics be that for so long and to be sort of grander than they really need to be, because we talked about this on the regular podcast. There's another season of Shadowlands after this is said and done. As we are here, there is a 9.2.5. There is potential time between now and the next expansion starting to do its pre-expansion stuff. That is time that we can explore a lot of these loose ends. And so the cinematic is, first of all, well done. As far as I'm concerned, I think it is very, very cinema-y is a really weird way to say it, but it has a very much like almost like a TV quality or a movie quality to it, with the flashbacks and that sort of final moment of the villain, who might not be maybe full villain, just to give you enough to sort of question what you did, which mission accomplished, but also just move you into the next phase. And we have all of this time of cleanup. We have all of this time of aftermath, which I think this might potentially be the first expansion we've had where we might actually get some time to deal with the aftermath. I can't think of another one where we've done that. It's been breakneck speed ever since. And at the end of Battle for Azeroth, we didn't have any time because everything that happened going into Shadowlands happened immediately after Battle for Azeroth. There was no grace period. So now we actually have an opportunity to maybe have some of that deeper diving into, well, what happened with the Jailer? Is the Pantheon of Death really what they say they are? What's going on with the universe? What is this seventh element or seventh force or whatever you want to call it? What is this great threat that we haven't considered? Also, where the hell is Denathrius? Because him and his sword are creepy and we can't just leave them to do whatever they're going to do. Plus, now we have all the Broker stuff that we have to kind of question and dive into as well, because Brokers play a pretty big part, especially Cartel's Eye, in everything that happens in Xerath Mortis and the Jailer's plans. What were they doing? What was their purpose? Was it just pure profit, et cetera, et cetera? We have a lot of things that we can start looking into, and that's exciting. So the cinematic wasn't to tie everything up. It was basically just to say, Jailer's done. Now go forth and deal with everything else. So, but I think that answers that question. So we're going to move on to our next one. And this one comes from KTS Stories. I'm listening to the discussion of the seventh force on the podcast, and the discussion of that force being a destruction or imbalance made me think of the Devourers. They exist outside of the force as we are used to. And in Xerath Mortis, we see them consuming the energies there and unraveling or exploding. Do you think they are the first hints of whatever the seventh force is? I actually do. And this is something I talked about a little bit last time, and then I'll turn it over to Matt to give his take on it. But one of the interesting things that we haven't talked about is the Devourers. They have sort of morphed and evolved throughout the course of this expansion, and it was not lost on me. It was one of those things where they started and they were very simple, mindless anima-consuming creatures. As they've been consuming the anima, and that's what they've been doing, they've been growing and evolving. They stopped being like blood ticks and giant monstrosities with no brain, to now in Korthia and Xerath Mordis, more humanoid, moving in packs, hunting in packs, showing a level of intelligence that we didn't think they had. It is interesting because they're starting to evolve. And that's not something we've talked about. That's not something that's explored really in game that I know of. I went looking for it this past week. I didn't see any quests really around it besides stop the Devourers, which is really what everything is. But they might be from that sort of destructive force. We're told that they exist in the space between realms, essentially, and they can teleport in. Why can they teleport into the Shadowlands? And now that they're consuming that anima, can they go elsewhere? Are they able to go elsewhere? Is that part of what they are? And are they part of this great devouring force that needs to be stopped? But then on the other side, if that's the case, why didn't the Jailer do anything to maybe do that? But at least that was my initial thought. But then I started looking at some of the world interactions. The Jailer's forces were fighting the Devourers just as much as we are. They weren't being set free. They weren't just being let loose. All of the Jailer's twisted monstrosities, you can find them fighting the Devourers in Korthia, in the Maw, in basically anywhere where his forces are. This might be the first hints at what's to come, and it might revolve around whatever space or entity that the Devourers hail from. And the interesting thing to me is they're also kind of flung into the Shadowlands, almost in a similar way as what was described with the old gods being flung from the void into Azeroth in basically the prime material plane. There might be something here, and I want to dig deeper into them. What do you think?
There's no seventh force, and the Devourers are not part of anything else. The Devourers and what is coming is a breakdown. It's not an entity. It may be an entity born out of the breakdown, but it isn't a power or a force. It's the thing. Let me put it this way. I can't pronounce the name because I only ever see it in game. I don't read it. But Caesara, the oracle from Xerath Mordis,
mm-hmm.
She says that the Devourers once had a job. They had a purpose. They were made for balance. But they've since become altered and now instead pose a threat to the design of the first ones. What does that mean? What were they balancing? How were they balancing it? Why do they drain anima to do what to exist? What does that have to do? Like, were they once part of the system that keeps all of these separate planes in harmony? Like, there was a period of time, it seems that the first ones, when they created existence, did so with the idea that all these various planes of existence would feed down into Azeroth. That the, and I say it to Azeroth, but I mean the realm that Azeroth is in, not just the world Azeroth. There's the, again, you use the word primaterial plane, that's as good as any, but there's that plane. Then there are the various cosmic planes that seem to feed and direct energy into that plane. It's where all these other forces become unified, but they're not unified anymore. Like, the Fel is actively inimical. The Void wants to destroy all existence. Aspects, death, you know, invades the realms of the living and creates abominations like the undead. There's beings of raw order are being hurled into our existence from the plane of Arcane and becoming the Titans. All these things seem to be, instead of all working together to create existence, they're in conflict. They're not balanced. And as they become imbalanced, the balancers seem to have become imbalanced as well. That the things that were made to maintain are now destroying. They're eating the fabric of existence. Anima is essentially the fabric of existence. It is the thing that makes things be. It's how the Shadowlands exist through the anima returning to them from the realm of where things live, from existence. And the Devourers are devouring it and throwing the Shadowlands out of whack And they might be doing something like that just behind all reality, if they were part of some purpose that they have since stopped serving. And I think if you think of it that way, if you think of there's the universe of purpose and creation and order, where you have to have void and the thousand truths because you need to have endless possibilities generated within it, but you also need to have the ability to pick one. You need to have a discernible goal, and that's where light comes in, and Fel brings the chaos, and Arcane brings the order. Death brings the world being renewed through the return of resources and existence to a fallow state to be regrown again. Life obviously is the force that drives the fuse through the flower and creates things that will eventually die and be returned. All of these things exist in opposition to each other. You know, life opposes death. Order, you know, the Arcane opposes chaos. You know, Arcane and Fel, they oppose each other. Light and void oppose each other. But through their interplay, they make the world. They make the understandable physical existence that we come from is birthed from that interplay, from the dance of them. But the dance isn't there anymore. Something broke it. And when I say there's no seventh force, I mean, there's what I'm trying to say is the thing that is happening is not because some outside entity is coming in to create it. It's because this system is disorganized, and it is that disorganization itself might have a mind and a will, and it might be doing things on purpose, but it originally comes from whatever broke the design in the first place. The cause of it is not, it's not a positive thing. It's not even like with void, void is describable, you know, for all the madness and all the chaos. Void, we know what void is. There's a thing there. You can tell someone this is what this is. Mm-hmm. The thing that is coming is not that. It is what happens if everything stops working. It's literally the grit in the gears. It's throwing water on your computer. It's that thing that is what we're talking about. That is my take on this. The Devourers, once I saw that the idea that they had purpose and were made for balance, I'm like, okay, if you think of balance as the thing that keeps the universe running, then imbalance is the thing that breaks it down. They're not devourers, they're annihilators. And when you said that you see them get more sophisticated as they devour more, they become more sophisticated because the more of a system you destroy, the more it begins to destroy itself.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you look at just a human body, you know, something as simple as a little piece of metal, if it impacts your body with enough force, it causes everything around it to start dying because stuff is popping, stuff is leaking, things are not working now. Once a system that is balanced stops working, it collapses. I think you could call the force entropy if you wanted to.
Yeah, you know, entropy might be a really good way to praise that, actually.
Yeah, I think it is. That is what's coming. It is entropy itself. It is the system is disorganized, and the disorganization is going to lead to a collapse. And the jailer's goal was to rewrite reality so that it couldn't be disorganized. And that might have worked, but it would have done so at the cost of what the first ones were trying to do in the first place.
Which makes sense,
make a
right?
Living cosmos. A living cosmos that interacted, that all its parts, you know. We call them the first ones, but we know nothing about them. We don't know what they were.
And we only call them the first ones because somebody else called them the first ones.
Because Zoval did.
And the brokers.
Yeah, but Zoval's the one who called them that when we first encountered them. The brokers do call them that as well, absolutely. They're also calling them the progenitors. But we really know nothing about them. We know nothing about where they came from. We don't know if the governing forces of reality existed before them. Mm-hmm. Like, did reality have those things before the first ones? We don't know. We know nothing. So it is actually really fascinating to even get the hints we've gotten. But yeah, it's
interesting.
There's going to be a lot to this before we actually know what it is. My take on it, though, is, as I've said, that it's like if you imagine the creation of the cosmos and as the first one's moment of triumph, something happened to break it down. And it could well be that the first ones are all dead, because we just went to the sepulcher of the first ones. It could be that they died somehow, and in so dying, introduced instability into their creation, and thus that's why it started breaking down. I don't know, but I definitely think it is that. It is that the system is breaking down.
All right. Well, hopefully that answers the question, or at least gives you some more things to ponder, but I think it's going to do it for that one. But I think we're going to have time for one last question, and this is going to come from Jaegerbomb. Is Azshara so powerful because she's on Azeroth? Does being on a giant source of arcane power supercharge her? On another world, would she just be good, not great? This is an interesting question because I don't think I've ever really considered it. Now that we've been talking more about what Titan Souls are or potentially are, and now that we have maybe a little bit of an understanding of what those souls or creations were intended possibly to do after making our way through the Shadowlands, there is a possibility of that. There is a possibility that Azshara was so great because she inadvertently is able to tap into the core of that being. One of the things that we know is that elves that were born with golden eyes were said to be creatures of great prophecy. They were supposed to have some great important task or something that was going to happen for them, right? That they were going to be fulfilling some legendary thing or another. But maybe it's something with how closely tied they are to sort of the world that they're on, or in this case, Azeroth. Who was it, Matt, that didn't start with golden eyes, but then got it was Malfurion, right?
Yep, Malfurion grew them, whereas his brother was born with them.
And he grew them as he became more in tuned with nature, right?
No, he grew them when he ripped a giant hole in Azeroth over the hole that it already had and allowed more of the core of the planet to leak forth into the world in the maelstrom.
Okay.
The place where the shamans later would hang out and make their magical base. That was created by Malfurion when he closed the portal and caused the feedback loop. That seat of power,
still a great thing of power. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
The seat of power that shamans draw from was his making. He did that when he collapsed the portal. His eyes went gold after that.
So, do you think that maybe him in that moment?
I don't think anything. I'm just throwing that out there for you guys to muse about. I have no opinion on this.
That's a lie. Come on.
Nope, you ain't getting it.
Well, this week. I want.
Let me put it to you this way. I will let you a little bit further down my path, but I'm not going to tell you what I'm thinking because I'm still thinking. The prophecy of golden eyes for night elves, if you compare to the way, say, all blood elves today have a chance to have golden eyes since they've come to embrace the power of Anaru in the Sunwell, a being of pure light that is feeding the Sunwell with its power. Illidan obviously was chosen by Zera, and she would have done something roughly equivalent to the light forging process to him had he let her. And that was one of the things, you know, his destiny was tied up in. That why, therefore, should Azshara, someone who we know ends up working alongside an old god, have been born with them? And what we talked about earlier and what we talked about with the jailer is the concept that the jailer comes to Azeroth because the realm which Azeroth lives in is composed of those six forces, as they're supposed to be in harmony and balance, but they're instead in disharmony and discord. And I think the devourers would fit very nicely as a concept of like manifest discord. They're literally the cosmos ripping apart around them, in them, through them. They are the means by which the cosmos is being torn apart. They were supposed to be the means by which the cosmos was going to balance itself and be maintained. So that's interesting to think about. If we think about Azshara, as we think about Neltharion, it's clear that the old gods seek to convert and control the greatest threats to them. And in Azshara's case, Azshara coveted the Well of Eternity. And I think there's a thing here. Just being on Azeroth is not going to make you more powerful than other magicians from other worlds. There are plenty of like examples. Khadgar didn't suddenly lose a step when he went to Outland. He didn't suddenly, I can't cast these spells anymore. Most magicians are not affected that way. But there is a big source of arcane power on Azeroth. Even before we knew about Azeroth as a world soul, we knew that the Well of Eternity and the water of the Well of Eternity was massively powerful. Even when you just took that water and put it into another source of water, that source of water became a magical font.
Mm-hmm.
They created a new Well of Eternity using its water. The Sunwells were created using its water, which we now know is like pure Azurite blood. So I don't think that she's more powerful because she's on Azeroth. I think that because she's on Azeroth, she can access more power because she knows where to get it and she knows what it is and has known for a very long time. She was studying the Well of Eternity. That's how Xavius ended up getting mind controlled and turned into a satyr. He was studying the Well of Eternity and what he could sense of the cosmos through it. So I don't want to keep going because the show would run out of time and there's a lot more to this that I'm still working on in my head, but I want you to think about that concept that we talked about Azeroth being the final Titan. What if the reason it's called the final Titan is because there's literally no other word that could be used to conceive of it?
Yeah, I was just going to say something similar, that I was going on that same rabbit hole. Yeah.
Yeah. There's this whole idea that, you know, what it is might be something far beyond the Titans we know of.
Which is why it's so coveted, which is why it's so important, which is all part of
the plan. Because it might be the end goal of that cosmos-defining chorus of order, the harmony they were trying to create. This is what that harmony is supposed to end in.
Mm-hmm.
This is the crescendo. This is the thing that it was all leading to. And as a result of that, because it's wounded and its essence is leaking forth, yeah, Ashara could use it to do great things. But I think her power comes from the fact that she is simply extremely intelligent and understands magic very well. Anybody who had her level of understanding could do it. Well, and if you took her off of Azeroth and went to, say, Outland, she'd still be an incredibly powerful mage. Because again, Khadgar didn't suddenly forget how to cast spells when he went to Outland. But she wouldn't have access to the Well of Eternity, and so she'd need another power source. Like, for instance, she needed the Pillars of Creation, or at least one of them, the Tidestone, to do some of the things she did. We saw her get the Tidestone and use that to create a big area that the water was now kept away from. And she did that just this kind of a tease. So she didn't want to use her own power. I think Ashara absolutely could have done that on her own power, but she didn't want to. She wanted to use another power source to save her own resources. And so I think that's the thing about Ashara.
And the interesting thing that you bring up is that it is something that she is intelligent. On the other side of the coin, I don't think Illidan gets enough credit as a mage. And if you go back and look at his story as well, like as his understanding of magic grew, he became insanely powerful because of that understanding of magic. There's a science to it as it's described in Warcraft.
If you look at the Illidan book, since you brought Illidan up, in the Illidan novel, he works out how to destroy a planet.
Yeah, 100%.
It's not, you know, I'm just so fell. He deliberately figures out how to cause a portal network to disintegrate and blow up a planet.
Mm-hmm.
And does it to the Nathrezim, of all people. They had a world that they were holding, and he just destroys it. That's Illidan's whole thing, where he embraced the fell, had nothing to do with Illidan being a fell demon who craved power. He just realized fell energy is less constricted by rules.
It's a different type of power source.
Yeah, it's a power source that I can use, and I don't have to do the same rigorous stuff I would have to do if I were doing this with Arcane. The downside is that it's going to eat me from the inside out, but I'm willing to pay that price. There's a lot to this. Yeah, I agree with you about Illidan. That was a good catch.
It's something that we'll probably explore again at some point, because I think there is a lot here. And this is a good question, because now it's starting to get us on at least me, and I don't want to speak for Matt, but it's starting a line of thinking that maybe I hadn't considered before. So I do want to thank you for that. But I do think that is going to do it for time for us. Blizzard Watch is made possible due to the generous contributions at patreon.com/BlizzardWatch. Your continued support means this podcast, site, and community is able to thrive and grow. Blizzard Watch supporters enjoy exclusive benefits like early access to the podcast, a better chance at having your question answered on our podcast or the queue, and an ads-free site experience. If you have questions for this podcast or any of our other podcasts, be sure to send them in. You can go ahead and send those questions to podcast@blizzardwatch.com or join our Discord server where patrons can throw those questions in our patron Q and podcast questions channel, where you will get first dibs at having your question answered on any of our podcasts. Or if you can't do that, go ahead and throw them into our Q and podcast questions channel that is for everybody. We will look there, and several of these questions did actually come from there. And just make sure you specify which show it is for so that we can go ahead and pull them into the appropriate categories. And as a one final reminder, all of us at Blizzard Watch continue to stand with the employees of Activision Blizzard, as well as all those in the game industry and tech industry that are currently demanding change for a better tomorrow, safer work environments, and equal treatment. One day I hope that we will never have to say that again, because it'll just be a thing that everybody has. But until next time, folks, yeah, it's been the Blizzard Watch. It's been the Lore Watch podcast. We'll see you next week.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.